Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of April. A couple of announcements. First, thanks to Veronica Rickard for filling in for me while I took a rather exotic vacation. We will this summer take a trip to northern Wisconsin, but we went to Belize and Cozumel and all the waters it takes to get there and every conceivable mode of transportation, I think, except a motorcycle. I'm trying to think what else. Or a horse. I wasn't on a horse either. No motorcycles, no horses, but it was an extraordinary trip. And here I am. We didn't have any newspapers. I mean, seriously, zero newspapers and not a heck of a lot of news. So fill me in if there is a gap in my knowledge. Please forgive me. I usually try to do my homework and I caught up in as many newspapers as possible yesterday and know the major stories, but there may have been a couple stories that I have missed. One more announcement. We have a very big guest for us tomorrow. You'll probably notice that in the New York Times, the book review section, the front page story is about The Bridge by David Remnick, who's a fabulous writer for The New Yorker. He has written The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, and he will be with us tomorrow at our 10 o'clock show. Also, at 9 o'clock tomorrow, a horrendous tragedy in Poland. Can you imagine the president and so many top officials and the first lady of Poland? Terrible air crash. We will be devoting the first hour of our program tomorrow. So lest you think we're ignoring that, the first hour of today's show, a full hour on that issue tomorrow. Did I tell you all things political? It's Monday. It's all things political. Back in the groove here. We have a great deal to talk about. Leaders from all over the world are attending a summit on nuclear terrorism. The president of our country has called it the single biggest threat to U.S. security. 47 countries are represented. They will be together for 2 days to try and how will they do this, tie up loose nukes. We will talk about that issue this hour. We were discussing the possibility and the probability of Justice John Paul Stevens leaving the Supreme Court. He has now said that he will do this, and evidently there's a bit of an uproar as to who the president should be nominating to fill that position. We will talk about that issue. Looking still at jobs and whatever you'd like this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can always send emails if you'd like to do that. That address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Timothy Johnson, professor of political science and co-director of the Institute of Law and Politics at the University of Minnesota, is our guest. His research and teaching interests include American politics, judicial politics, Supreme Court decision-making, Supreme Court oral arguments, executive-judiciary relations, and the evolution of the norm of respecting precedent. And Professor Johnson, we welcome you to the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me,
yeah,
Kathleen.
Our great pleasure. Well, let's start with what we thought was going to happen and did while I was gone, and Justice John Paul Stevens deciding he would step down. And I guess there's a bit of a political uproar, which I've missed, about his replacement, the Republicans are worried about who the president may nominate. What do you think?
Well, I mean, clearly that uproar has begun already, as you said. I think the problem with the argument is that the person who is leaving, Justice Stevens, is widely considered the most liberal member of the bench right now. And so it's interesting that there would be such an uproar because replacing him, even with someone who is equally as liberal, will simply not change the balance of the court yet. There's still a pretty well-entrenched conservative majority on the bench. Now, of course, Justice Kennedy moves to the other side from time to time, but largely he votes with the four-member conservative bloc. And so, you know, it does interest me that there will be such an uproar simply, or that there is such an uproar simply because this will ultimately probably be a new liberal justice replacing a liberal justice who is leaving.
Right. You would expect that it would be that. If it would be otherwise, I would think Democrats would be in an uproar.
I think that's right, and I think that that's probably the balancing act that President Obama will have to do, and that is picking someone who he has said publicly is confirmable, and that is someone who is more moderate or even maybe a little bit right-leaning, although not too far right-leaning, versus someone who you would consider maybe more liberal. I think that ultimately this is going to be someone who will probably be both. And the reason that is that to say that Justice Stevens is the most liberal member of the bench right now doesn't say a whole lot when you compare him to the great liberal justices of the past, a William Brennan or a Thurgood Marshall. This liberal bloc in the court is more moderate than it is liberal. So my guess is, in the end, while there may be a fight for the sake of there being a battle, there's not going to be someone on the bench who's going to be, you know, a radical liberal, if you will.
Right. Tell me how he changed. He was considered fairly moderate some years ago. Isn't it interesting that we consider him a liberal, and you say the most liberal member of the court now? What happened?
Well, I think that's right. I think that the way that we want to think about it is not that he changed so much, but more so that the court changed. Justice Stevens did an interview on 60 Minutes about a year and a half ago now, where he said he believes he's just as conservative today as he was when he was put on the bench in 1975, and I think that's probably largely true. Now, what he meant was not that he was ideologically conservative, but that he's judicially conservative. He is a restraintist. He doesn't want to make broad decisions. He doesn't want to act in an activist role. And so that was his belief. And so I think political science and legal scholarship has borne this out, and that is that the court around him has moved more than he has moved. And the fact of the matter is the court has just gotten so much more conservative, and he simply hasn't.
Mm-hmm. Can you toss out some names, some possibilities? I thought it was interesting that I believe it was Arianna Huffington suggested Elizabeth Warren should be the next Supreme Court Justice. Which is interesting. When you look at the backgrounds of almost everybody, they have the same kind of path. They went to the same schools. Do you think that we'll get somebody who wasn't on the bench somewhere that has a very different background?
Well, I think that is possible. I mean, the fact of the matter is that even though most of these folks have the same background, some are on the bench and some are not. And so, of course, the biggest name right now that is thrown about is Elena Kagan, the Solicitor General for the Obama administration right now. And she's never sat, right? She she's in the administration now, and she was the dean of Harvard Law School. But certainly she has not been on the bench. Of course, there's also Janet Napolitano, former governor of Arizona, now head of Homeland Security. Neither of her, she as well, is not ever sat on the bench. Now, I think the interesting part about these two, and there's others as well that we can discuss, is that this court no longer has any non-judges. And another way to think about it is this court has no politicians. The last justice on the bench to hold political office was Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And there are those who believe that we need folks not only from the political world, but who have experience that is not sitting on the bench and being cloistered, writing decisions for their entire careers. And so I think it could be an interesting choice, especially if the president goes with someone who has not previously been on a lower bench.
What do you think? Should the president go that way? Would that be good?
You know, I think that there is clear merit to the idea of not having all judges on the bench, those who are lifetime judges. It brings a different perspective. I think that Justice O'Connor clearly had a different perspective on legal issues and other policy issues that came to the bench simply because she did have to broker political deals when she worked in the Arizona state government. Earl Warren, right, governor of California before he becomes the Chief Justice in 1952, very much had a different outlook. So I do think that this could be important. I'm not certain that I would want a bench full of folks who have no judicial experience, but I think having a few there clearly helps matters.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing that people can serve and be really sharp and get up and go to work every day when they're 90 years old having this job?
Oh, that's right. Justice Stevens is an amazing man. I mean, he continues to play tennis and I don't know if he'd been in the past year or so, but I mean, within the past couple of years, was still playing tennis a few days a week down in Fort Lauderdale. And I think that when you have a passion for what you do, you don't want to leave. I mean, you even see this in Chief Justice Rehnquist before he passed away in 2005. He did not want to leave. He continued to come to work. when he couldn't sit for oral argument, when he was going through his cancer treatment, he would listen to the oral argument tapes so that he could participate in the decision-making process of those cases. So, you know, yeah, these folks get old, but the passion that they have, I think, really keeps them young. When I saw Justice Stevens interviewed on C-SPAN this weekend and giving a tour of his chambers, I didn't think he looked 90. I mean, he looks much younger than that, still very spry.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the cases that were very, very influential that he had a large part in, and also the upcoming cases that whoever the president nominates will have a long-lasting effect on all of our lives.
Yeah. I think that there's a number of cases that you can think about with John Paul Stevens that he had his hand in recent ones, some of those being major dissents and some of those being majority opinions he wrote. So maybe one of the most important recent majority opinions that he wrote was in Atkins versus Virginia in the year 2002, where he was the head of a majority that said that it is no longer acceptable to execute those who are mentally handicapped, mentally retarded. And that really had a big effect on the way that we look at the death penalty in the United States. On the other hand, he had a major hand in telling the President of the United States that he is no longer immune from lawsuits in Clinton versus Jones in 1997. And then maybe one of the most influential cases from the mid-1980s, Wallace versus Joffrey, which was a majority opinion he wrote that basically said public schools may not engage in their students in silent prayers during the school day.
Hmm. And of course, in the cases that will be coming up, the death penalty, I mean, the gun control case will be decided by Stevens, the Chicago case, right?
Yep, that case he will definitely have a hand in. And I would suspect, especially given his dissent in Heller in 2008, the Washington, D.C. gun case, I suspect he will most likely be in the majority or in the minority in the Chicago case as well. And I also suspect will be writing just as scathing a dissent. And I would suspect similar in the death penalty case, although this death penalty case is one that I'm not certain many folks suspected the court would take in terms of where it will go with its decision. I think it's possible he could end up in the majority in that case.
Let's move to a couple other stories, and I'm sure our listeners will bring us back to this one.
Sure.
What a horrendous tragedy in Poland over this weekend. Oh, my goodness, can you imagine to lose all of those top officials, the president, his wife? Oh, my.
Unimaginable that such a tragedy could take place, and I don't think that we as Americans could ever envision that happening. I mean, it's bad enough when a president gets shot, as President Reagan did, or killed as President Kennedy was. But to have that many high-ranking officials at one time, I'm not exactly sure where you begin.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to talk about that for a full hour tomorrow morning. The president has invited leaders from around the world to a summit, 47 countries represented. He said that nuclear terrorism is the single biggest threat to the United States security, and they want to tie up loose nukes. How important are these meetings? How big is the threat to U.S. security?
You know, I suspect, and I'm not an expert on issues of security, but I suspect that, in fact, small nuclear devices are a big threat to the United States. I mean, you think about dirty bombs and the like, and I think that is much more likely the scenario in which there would be a nuclear attack taking place in this world, not only in the United States but beyond. The idea of intercontinental ballistic missiles being the weapon of choice is probably more history now than something that I think could actually or would actually happen, unless you have a problem with India or Pakistan. But in the United States, I think it's more likely that we would be attacked with small nuclear devices. And I think that's the point of this, that, as you said, rounding up loose nukes to guarantee that the materials that you use for those bombs are not used for smaller bombs.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the president calling this kind of meeting? This guy is pretty busy, isn't he? You think about all these issues. They're big issues, and they happen one after another.
No, I think that it's not stopping for him. And I think that the whole notion of making this one of the keys to his foreign policy is very important. And I also think that it's a step away from the domestic fights that he has been having, because he's going to continue with one. It's revving up again in Congress with the jobs bill that was not passed in, or the bill for unemployment benefits, which wasn't passed in March, which they're going to be debating this week again. And so I think it's another way to be able to step into another issue that maybe he can have a really good effect on.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about jobs and the economy. I was watching news last night, and it was centering on California. California gets a lot of attention here. The number of people who are facing very long furloughs, they have a budget they just can't deal with, and they're going to have to cut jobs that many of us would think would be necessary jobs. I was with some friends in Florida over the weekend who were both teachers, retired now, and that state is looking at big changes in pensions for teachers. States are really having a very, very difficult time here in trying to cover some necessary services. What's the role of the administration in trying to make things better?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't think that there's an easy answer. I mean, one of the key roles is to make sure that people who are losing their jobs continue to be covered. And so there is the battle that's going to go on to extend COBRA benefits as well as extend unemployment benefits to folks. I mean, I read one statistic that as of the 5th of this month, more than 200,000 unemployed folks had already exhausted their job benefits in the states. And so I think that the role is not only monetary, that is trying to extend these sorts of benefits to make sure that people don't lose homes, that people can continue to stand on their feet. But I think the other is the leadership, and that is try to guide states through this really difficult economic time.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Professor Timothy Johnson, Professor of Political Science, Co-Director of the Institute of Law and Politics at the University of Minnesota. We've touched on a couple important things. The Supreme Court, Justice John Paul Stevens saying at the age of 90, he is ready to maybe play a little bit more tennis. And the president having this summit concerning loose nuclear material and trying to get control of that, get rid of all of it. The tragedy in Poland, jobs. I've been away for a week, so bring up the other issues that you think are important. I'm sure I've missed some of them. Here's our phone number. Please join the conversation at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. It's always interesting to hear what a well-informed audience would have to say about what direction the president ought to go in terms of nominating a new member of the United States Supreme Court. What about these nuclear weapons, these loose nukes? Is it a huge concern, a huge threat to U.S. security? What should we be doing about that? We'd love to hear from you. Okay? Okay. And we'll take your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Luther Castillo, who has been featured in the movie Salud and is now leading the largest international health mission in Haiti. He represents a different approach to the healthcare crisis affecting not only this country, but also the world, where there is a huge brain drain of medical talent from developing nations, even without natural disasters such as the earthquakes in Haiti and in Chile. He is one of the first Honduran doctors from the Afro-Indigenous Garifuna population and went to medical school in Havana, and he has a very, very interesting life story to tell, and the work that he's doing is most important. So that's coming up, hour number two. All right, to your phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number. Colleen from Decorah, Iowa is our first caller. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
You know, this actually comes from a kind of a Facebook conversation that I saw. I'm wondering if to be nominated for the Supreme Court justice, are there any requirements like birthplace or age like there are for president and Congress?
That's a great question. The answer is there are not. There are simply no requirements for being on the bench. And, in fact, you do not even need to be an attorney. You do not need to hold a JD. Now, that's the constitutional requirement set out in Article 3. That is, there are none. There are norms, though. I do not think that you will get anywhere near being nominated to the bench without having been a lawyer, without the JD and probably a higher degree. And you probably will not be nominated to the bench if you're 21 years old or 22 years old right out of law school if you've done it that quickly. That said, you know, Chief Justice Roberts was nominated when he was quite young. Justice Clarence Thomas was nominated when he was quite young. So there's not necessarily an age requirement. And in terms of age, you want to balance from having someone who is established for their career as well as someone who you want on the bench for a long period of time for a legacy. But in the end, no requirements necessarily for being on the bench in terms of age or qualifications.
You sound like you have somebody in mind, Colleen.
Well, a friend of mine who is an attorney just commented that she wondered, you know, what the makeup would look like after the next, changeover. And one of her other friends said, well, I think it should be you. And I happen to know that she was born in China, and, you know, it just got me thinking about that.
No, it's a good question. In fact, unlike the president, there's also no requirement in terms of being native-born in the United States, just like members of Congress. You're right. The only requirement for members of Congress is that you live that you're a citizen of the United States and you live within the district or the state within which you're running. For the court, no such requirement.
Okay, interesting.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
I was reading about Stevens a little bit yesterday in the makeup of the court and found this interesting. I didn't know this, that his retirement makes possible, the New York Times is saying, something that would have been unimaginable a generation or two ago, a court without a single member of the nation's majority religion, Protestant.
Oh, I think that's right. And I do believe that folks are going to talk about this. That you now have, with if you pull Stevens out of the equation, six Catholics and two members of the Jewish faith. And, you know, I think that in days gone by, people maybe would have worried about this more. So, you know, take the comparison of a Justice Scalia and a Justice Sotomayor, who are both strong Catholics, but they simply look at the world and the law in very different ways. And so you can't, I think, say just because someone is Catholic that they will rule in a particular way or that they will view the world in a particular way. Now, I do think that if they're, you know, with no Protestants on the bench, folks will talk about that. Will there be an effect? Probably not. Now, back in the day, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, when there were considerations like religion on the bench, and we talked more openly about things like the Jewish seat, I think people may have been more concerned. I think it will be part of the conversation. I don't think that it will be a big part of the conversation in the end.
Mm-hmm. The Jewish seat was interesting. I couldn't believe this. It's in the same article. The court had to cancel its portrait in 1924 because Justice James McReynolds, an anti-Semite and a racist, refused to sit next to Justice Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish justice. Isn't that incredible?
You know, it was even worse than that. I talked to my students about this with Justice McReynolds, and it wasn't just the portrait that was canceled. When justices retire from the bench, all of their colleagues do it very sort of traditional things, and one of them is they write a letter of congratulations and they all sign it. McReynolds refused to sign Justice Brandeis's retirement letter. The justices all have this wonderful tradition before they go out for oral arguments of going into the cloakroom and putting on their robes and shaking everyone's hand, every single person. Justice O'Connor talked about this quite a bit. Every justice shakes every other justice's hand before they go out so that they know that there's collegiality between them, even though they're going to maybe fight over an issue. McReynolds would not touch Brandeis. He would
goodness.
His hand for all the tea in China.
Oh, my goodness. And he's a Supreme Court justice.
Yes.
I don't care what year it was. Wow.
Yes, different days.
Different days. Reed from Clintonville. Hi.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Reed.
Hey, I have a question and a comment. And the question is whether or not President Obama, who is a U.S. citizen, could change the Chief Justice. Does he have the right to appoint someone and then appoint that person as a Chief Justice, as the former office holder of the presidency, a pseudo president did? And then my comment is that I find it interesting that there are no either agnostic or atheistic individuals on the Supreme Court, and I wonder how that might impact the court if there were.
Okay, so in terms of your question, the answer is no. The only time a president would be able to replace a Chief Justice is if the Chief Justice seat is vacant. And so, you know, the John Roberts situation was interesting because he was not nominated for the Chief Justiceship initially. He was nominated to replace Justice O'Connor, and it was not until Chief Justice Rehnquist passed away that the administration said strategically, we will replace Roberts, or will replace Rehnquist with Roberts. And I don't think there was a problem with that because the nomination or confirmation hearings had not even started. And even if they had, they probably would have been able to make the same move. But you only get to replace the justice who is leaving the court. In terms of your comment on agnostics or atheists, I mean, I would say the same thing for the administration, the executive branch, as well as the legislature. I don't know of many agnostics or atheists, or at least well-known ones, in Congress. It certainly would change the views of certain situations. Maybe the Newdow case, where the court decided was potentially going to decide the Pledge of Allegiance issue. But on most issues, I don't think that you're going to get a big difference, you know, in antitrust cases or tax cases or things like that.
Mm-hmm. And moving just slightly from the court for a moment, because we're on the subject of religion, I'd like to hear your comments on what's facing the Catholic Church and the Pope right now. This story just keeps going on and getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly difficult issue. I mean, you know, you talk to people, experts, as well as people in the media or people in the public, and you know, sometimes there's the conclusion that says, look, the Pope is only the head of a church. He's not a head of state or anything like that. But when you look at it, the Pope really sort of plays the role of head of state of the Vatican, which is its own sovereign nation in this world. And I think that there are troubled days continuing ahead. I think the letter that I heard about this weekend on the news, where as a cardinal, the Pope had, at the time, and I forget how many years ago this was, had decided that the church was not going to get rid of yet a priest who had been, in fact, convicted, I believe, of molesting a young boy. And instead, the letter that was written by the then cardinal, now Pope, said, we need to balance what happened in this case with the good of the church and the good it will do for the world more generally. And I think if those sorts of letters and those sorts of issues continue to come out, I think the Catholic Church is in a lot of trouble.
I think so, too. It's hard for them to be a voice of moral authority at this point, or to have much influence. And also, you know, in places like Ireland, the Catholic Church has been very influential in determining, you know, politics in some ways, what positions are going to be on abortion and on divorce, et cetera.
No, I think that's right. And I think that you hit the nail on the head, Kathleen, and that is a voice of moral authority that is now having, you know, one of the most immoral scandals, or at least potentially immoral scandals, that it has ever faced. And that will be problematic when it wants to speak with that sort of moral authority.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to Bill from Eau Claire.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I recently heard, I think this morning, that the Senate, the state Senate, is going to be taking up the assembly bill on Native American logos in our public schools. And I was just wondering what your opinion was on probability of that passing, to help, you know, just as a comment, we've had this issue in many communities around the state where it really is such a divisive issue, and school boards and communities are just ripped apart when they try to address this.
And I should tell you that Professor Johnson is at the University of Minnesota, but I would imagine that you've had the same kind of debate in Minnesota.
Oh, very clearly. I mean, we've had the debate here, and in fact, our university athletic department has followed very closely the debate surrounding the the impetus for this discussion more generally, and that is the University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux, which is no longer going to be its mascot. You know, this is a really tough issue for the simple reason that you have the two sides of the debate, right? One is the equal protection issue, and that is we do want to make sure that we give everyone equal protection of the laws, and if we have public schools who are supporting racist epithets, or at least allegedly racial epithets for, in this case, Native American tribes, that's a problem because now you're really harming the equal protection of those members of the tribes. On the other hand, you have the First Amendment issue, and that is, right, you've got the free speech rights to say what you want. The question is, does that apply to public schools? You know, I don't know the likelihood that such a law will pass in Wisconsin, but I think after the state Supreme Court decision in North Dakota, I think it probably makes it more likely that legislatures like the legislature in Wisconsin will pass such laws and they will be held up. I think that historically we have just come to a point in this country where we have said enough is enough and we're no longer going to allow those sorts of names.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks very much for your call. Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There was an event this weekend in Republican politics, the Southern Leadership, Republican Leadership Conference. You know, this is a beauty contest where all the hopefuls and potential hopefuls for the Republican nomination for president get together and speak and, you know, talk about the Republican Party and so forth. And the interesting result was that that Mitt Romney and Ron Paul tied for first place. This is one of these events where you have to get your people out to show up at the event because those are the people who are going to do the voting. And as usual, there was a little bit of trouble because the Republican Party doesn't want Ron Paul to do well. It's kind of an embarrassment for them. And so, you know, there were some shenanigans, but nonetheless, he was able to tie with 24% between the two of them. Sarah Palin coming in kind of a more distant third with 18%, and Newt Gingrich tied also for third. And then some people like Pawlenty and so forth were down in the single digits, 2%, and so forth. So I thought that was an interesting conclusion. Ron Paul won the big CPAC conference straw poll too, and so I think there's an interesting grassroots dynamic there for Ron Paul, and you won't see much coverage of it in the mainstream. I've looked over some of the big news sites on the internet, and it's mostly talking about how Mitt Romney was the winner of the thing, and less talk about Ron Paul, although there is more than there was in the last go round.
Yeah, you know, I think that two comments on this. One is I think that Ron Paul is getting all sorts of support because of the Tea Party movement, right? I mean, a large portion of the Tea Party movement is the libertarian aspect of it. So if you have gone to any of the Tea Party gatherings, there's a huge libertarian bent to it, and that's where he's coming from. And I think that the GOP then walks a really fine line, because you're right, I agree with the caller that he may in fact be an embarrassment for the GOP, but on the other hand, these folks have come out in massive numbers to these Tea Party rallies, the rally in Minneapolis last week for Michelle Bachmann that Sarah Palin attended. And the party wants those people because they want the vote. Now, they may not want the Ron Paul side of it, but they certainly want those people to come out and vote GOP. You know, these straw polls, as the caller notes, are also really, really difficult to say anything worthy about, for the simple reason that, as the caller points out, I mean, this is a get out the vote. This is the Ron Paul people or the Mitt Romney people. Now, I'm not saying they did it in this case, but this is what usually happens in these straw polls. Come out and we'll give you a steak dinner, or come out and we'll give you a coupon to go to X restaurant, and if you come out and vote for us, you know, we'll do something good for you. And so it's really hard to have any of these polls mean anything. And the last point on this is these polls are so early, right? I mean, you think about Governor Pawlenty here in Minnesota. No one knows who he is nationally yet, although he seems to be everywhere. He's only polling in the single digits. But Bill Clinton was the same way in 1990 and 1991 as he was revving up to run in 92.
I always thought when I first heard him speak that Pawlenty would be the rising star of the Republican Party, and we were going to hear a lot from him. in the years ahead. Do you think that that's true, or is the party really struggling to find out who their leader is?
I think that party is still struggling to find out who its leader is, and that's sort of odd for the simple reason that the president numbers now are down. They're, again, with the rise of the Tea Party movement, there's this conservative big move in throughout the whole United States, you know, maybe trying to make a huge watershed election come November. And it's unclear to me whether our governor has actually been passed up or not. As I said, he is everywhere now. He showed up at the Bachman-Palin rally, and it was unclear whether he was initially welcomed. And so he's trying to, A, make himself look much more conservative than maybe he has been in the past, and B, try to get much more visibility. What he is continuing and will continue to hang his hat on is the idea that he refused, unlike George Herbert Walker Bush with his No New Taxes pledge, he has refused his entire 8 years to raise taxes, and it has not happened. And while you can quibble about whether the fees that have been raised in state parks and for other things in the state are actually an increase in taxes, he has stuck to that pledge that the word tax increase has never been in a bill that he has signed.
Hmm. We're talking this hour of the program, All Things Political. Monday at 9 is All Things Political. Professor Timothy Johnson is our guest, professor of political science, co-director of the Institute of Law and Politics at the University of Minnesota. His special area is, of course, law and politics, as I just said, American politics, judicial politics, Supreme Court decision-making, Supreme Court oral arguments, executive-judiciary relations, and the evolution of the norm of respecting precedent. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation, move it in whatever political direction you would like, or comment more on what we've already been discussing. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, we haven't had any of those today, but if you'd like to send an email, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Dr. Luther Castillo, who is founder and director of the Hospital for the Health of Our People in Honduras. Currently, he's supervising the largest international medical mission in Haiti. If you'd like to join us for All Things Political, lines open at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Charles from Ingleside, Illinois is next. Hi, Charles.
Kathleen, Professor Johnson, get back to the pedophile business. If our kids are abused by anybody, any pervert, you go to the police. You don't go to your pastor, your bishop, and you stay away from Rome. If the Pope tried to do anything over here with force against a priest in this country, you'd hear more about that than you do about pedophile business. So anyway, don't call the Pope. Call the police if your kids are molested.
I think the caller is absolutely right.
Yeah, it is criminal behavior, isn't it?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yep, without a doubt. Let's look a little bit. You were talking about the president's popularity figures, and let's talk a little bit more about the Republicans. There is more attention focused now on midterms coming up soon. Is there great dissatisfaction, do you think, with the current administration or people? Is there a big anti-incumbent, no matter if you're Democratic or Republican, thing going on? What are your – and I hate to ask this because it's 7 months away. But what is going on with that? Are we happy or not?
I think that people are unhappy. I think that there is not only the movement, you know, that was personified by the healthcare debate, that there's this but people are unhappy with the current administration. But I think it's broader than that. And I think if you talk to most political experts, they'll say that this is an anti-incumbent, anti-Washington problem. And so I heard a story this morning as I was driving my kids to work about the seat for Evan Bayh the Democratic senator from Indiana who is retiring because he was fed up with how bad things have gotten in Washington. Well, you know, three of the folks who are running for that seat are running on an anti-Washington ticket. Now, the irony is that all three of them have spent most of their careers in Washington.
In Washington, right.
It's them, not me. And, in fact, there's a lot of evidence in political science to suggest, right, that people are generally happy with their representatives, right? In Wisconsin, you all, for the most part, like Senator Feingold and Senator Cole. But if you look at those same polls, people in Wisconsin are going to say they don't like what's going on in the Senate and they don't like how the Senate's run. And that just, you know, is sort of a fact of life for members of Congress. So I think it's both. I think people are unhappy with the administration, but equally across the board, people are unhappy with Washington. I think in the end, you're going to see a pretty typical midterm election. You know, I won't make any specific predictions. I don't, as you said, I don't like to do that, especially 7 months out. But I think that you can suspect that there will be several seats lost by the Democrats in the Senate. And you can expect, and I was thinking about this question today, so I tried to look at as many pundits as possible. And it comes down to the Democrats probably losing between 20 and 30 seats. And that's not enough for them to lose control in the House. But it will be the sorts of hits that the Democrats took, say, in 1994. On the other hand, there are some pundits who suggest that the Democrats will be more prepared this time around than in 94. I think that they were sort of fat and rich and happy in 94 and didn't see the train wreck coming when Newt Gingrich came in with the Republican Revolution and took over the House. Democrats are raising money more quickly in larger numbers more quickly. They're attacking any potential candidates more quickly right out of the gate. So I don't think they're sitting back in their laurels. That said, with conventional wisdom, with sentiment in the country, they're going to lose some seats in both houses.
And they could lose that many because of unhappiness over health care that was passed, or because of what?
Well, I think it's both. I think that folks are unhappy with the health care reform bill that was passed. I think they're unhappy because, as I said, you know, 20 minutes or so ago, that there's 200,000 people who are now going to be off their unemployment benefits.
Yes.
Because they've exhausted them. The jobless numbers are not getting a whole lot better, although we saw some good news last month. I think that people just believe the economy, with the direction of the country, people are still unhappy about the bailouts. And I also think that in the end, folks just have this strong anti-government, anti-Washington attitude right now.
Mm. We'll go back to jobs in a moment. Let's go to Cindy. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good morning, Professor Johnson. This is Cindy Conlon from Northwestern. How are you doing?
Oh, good to hear from you, Cindy.
I'm getting ready for class on the Supreme Court. I know everybody's going to want to talk about Stevens all the time today. So I have two quick questions for you. I happen to just catch you here as opportune. In terms of the dynamic of oral argument on the Supreme Court, this might be a little technical for your listeners, Kathleen, but I'll give you an anecdote, too, that might make it more generally interesting. What might be the effect on the actual argument dynamics of the court without Justice Stevens? And then secondly, I wanted to ask you your opinion about whether Justice Thomas might ever speak in our lifetime. But for Justice Stevens, a quick anecdote. Some of his clerks were commenting on his personality and his contribution to the court, and we talked about a Catholic seat. And I might suggest he's the courteous seat. He's the most kind, gentle of the justices, prefacing his questions usually with, "May I?" Where the other justices are, you know, just jumping in and interrupting in much more aggressive style.
Wow.
And during one argument, the poor nervous attorney kept addressing the justices as Judge Souter and Judge Ginsburg, and Chief Justice Rehnquist at the time corrected this person over again. And finally, Justice Stevens jumped in and says, "Counsel, don't worry, the Constitution makes the same mistake," trying to put the advocate at ease. And that is just what he does, and no one else fills that role. Would you agree?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think that David Souter tried to a little bit, but he would ask such long-winded, difficult questions sometimes that it was hard for him to have that empathetic side come out from him. But I agree 100%, Cindy, that we're going to lose something with Stevens. Now, here is the other side of it. Justice Stevens, in his small, meek voice with his bow tie on, would say, you know, "May I please interrupt you?" But then there were times where he would skewer an attorney just as well as a Justice Scalia does it. But as you said, he did it in a way that tried not to really sort of trample on that attorney. So I think it's a really good point, and I think we're going to really miss something. And you saw that with Justice Sotomayor when she joined the bench. She jumped right in, and she jumped in with her fists up, coming out swinging at attorneys just like most of her colleagues. As for Justice Thomas, I think the answer is no. I think we're not going to hear from him. I think it's been 4 years, again, since we've heard from him. I saw him about 3 weeks ago when he was on campus at our law school, and he again reiterated the fact that he just doesn't think that there's any need to ask questions. He's gotten everything he believes he needs from the briefs, and he thinks his colleagues make fools of themselves by asking so many questions. So I think the answer is just a clear no.
What was he doing a presentation of some kind at Minnesota?
He was actually teaching a one-week short-term
really?
Course in the law school.
Huh.
Yeah.
Was he a good teacher?
I don't know. I did not sit in on a class. I've seen him speak, and I will say this. He's a pretty good speaker. And he was here because one of his former clerks is on staff in the law school.
Oh, interesting.
Well, I appreciate it, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy. How do you two know each other?
You know what? Cindy teaches at Northwestern, and I teach at the U of M, and we both have an interest in oral argument. And so we've talked over email several times, and we've actually met a couple of times to talk about some research.
Oh, how interesting.
Small world.
The magic of radio.
I know.
I know. Thanks, Cindy, very much for the call. I want to go back to jobs for just a moment here.
Sure.
Have you seen any kind of indication that the money that did go for job stimulus has done anything? Are we getting bridges built or roads repaired or green energy jobs being created? What happened to that money?
You know, I actually think that that money is still out there, and I can just speak from experience here that there are several projects here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area that are ongoing and that will continue to go because of the stimulus money. Now, I don't know nationally, but I suspect that we're a microcosm of what that money looks like nationally, and I think it just takes a while to rev up projects. Now, I'm not an expert on this area of policy, but what I do know is, right, you can't just throw money and say that the jobs are going to start. It takes time, and so a project that has particular interest in my life is an interchange that needs to be changed around our house in order to make traffic flow better. That's going to begin in the coming months, but it just took that time to rev up that project, get the bids done, get the company that was going to come and do it to get ready to hire the particular folks. And so I think that you're going to see more and more of that money being spent and being used, although a good portion of it already is being used.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back to those people, 200,000 losing unemployment benefits. What in the world are those people going to do?
Yeah, I don't know. They're in a really tough spot. I think what they hope is that the Senate and the House ultimately pass this bill to extend the benefits. Now, this is a dangerous place for the Republicans, right? The Republicans are seen, and many folks on the talk shows this weekend talked about it, and pundits online have been talking about it as well, and that is, right, the Republicans said no to health care, and they voted straight party line in both houses, no to the health care reform bill. Okay,
mm-hmm.
They stopped the extension of jobless unemployment benefits to folks in March, and now it's coming back up again. If they say no to this, and then they turn around and potentially say no or try to filibuster an Obama nominee to the Supreme Court, I think they start treading in some dangerous water when the elections come up in November. And that is, they're riding pretty high right now. And I think, as we talked a couple of minutes ago, they can expect to have some pretty decent gains in both the House and the Senate. If they continue to be obstructionist on very high-profile things, and I would not say that the Supreme Court is as high-profile as making sure that folks have unemployment benefits, or at least not as important to people's lives in particular, the GOP could be in some trouble.
So the party of not just no, but hell no, maybe needs to move in another direction?
I think that's right. And I think that until, and I think this is why Evan Bayh left, and not because he was a Democrat and he's upset with the minority party, but I think that he's upset that the entire tenor has changed in Washington from 20 and 30 years ago, where members of Congress are able to work together and make sure that they get things done for the good of the country. And I won't just blame the Republicans. It's both parties. When it has become me as a candidate and us as a party before it becomes us, or before it is us as a country.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Professor Johnson. Just in the last 30 seconds we have, what should we be paying close attention to this week? Obviously, the meeting of all of the people coming in for tying up loose nukes. What else?
I think that you want to pay attention to what happens in politics in Poland.
Yes.
I think we want to pay attention to what's going to happen with this unemployment extension or benefits bill. And very clearly, you want to, especially near and dear to my heart, be paying attention to who these potential nominees are to the bench.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. It's been fun.
It was wonderful. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much. Professor Timothy Johnson, a professor of political science and co-director of the Institute of Law and Politics at the University of Minnesota, our guest for all things political this hour. He teaches and has special interest in American politics and Supreme Court, how they make their decisions, the evolution of the norm of respecting precedent. He is the author of Oral Arguments and Decision Making on the U.S. Supreme Court and the co-author of Religious Institutions and Minor Parties in the United States. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing that hour. Thank you, John Treader, for on-air production. I want to remind you that during the 10 o'clock hour tomorrow, this book is just been published, and it's an exhaustive look at pre-inauguration of President Obama, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. David Remnick will be our guest at 10 o'clock tomorrow. Okay, news coming up, and we'll return.